Welcome to Middle Grade Mavens, where two author mums discuss their favourite middle grade books, provide recommendations, and share insider industry tips for authors trying their hand at middle grade. Julie Ann Grasso is the author of the Frankie DuPont mystery series, cupcake enthusiast and part-time library book wrangler. Pamela Ukerman is a writer, dancer, and homeschooling mum who sometimes finds time for sleep. Both Julie and Pamela devour middle grade books, not only for research, but to share with their combined brood of four munchkins. Hello and welcome back to Middle Grade Mavens for our 51st episode.
Our 51st episode, yes. How are you holding up, Jules?
We're doing our part. We're staying home. It's kind of funny because I was just lamenting to Pamela earlier that we kind of stay home a lot anyway. and we have work from home desks already set up because we've done a lot of that in our time. So I am, you know, just trying to keep positive, but yeah, the kids are feeling it, I guess. So
yeah, they would. Yeah, we're quite used to staying home as well, given that we homeschool and my two boys are homebodies. But, not to the level that we are at the moment. So we're going a little bit stir crazy. And we do have a backyard. Thank goodness for our backyard. Yes. It's my saving grace because with two active boys who do a lot of sports and go to the park a lot, they just need to run around a lot. They are getting far too much screen time, but, you know.
Yep.
School holidays now here in Victoria, so we don't need to be doing homeschooling, and we always plan to have these 2 weeks off.
Yeah.
Not the usual, but at least we have the podcast, right?
Oh, yes. Mavens press on.
That's right. We do, and we're pressing even harder at the moment for you listeners because we have decided to squeeze in a bonus episode in the near future. We were concerned about the state of the children's book industry and the effects of the pandemic and what impact it's having on the publishers and booksellers. So we're putting together a little bonus episode with a couple of interviews to help keep everyone in the know as to how the industry is faring. And at the same time, we are promoting any authors and illustrators who have books coming out in the next few months whose book launches and events have been cancelled. We are promoting those all on social media. So if you are an author who has a book coming out soon and you haven't already sent us your details, please do, and we'll put it out there.
Yeah, we've had a really great response, you know, people contacting us, and it's just really nice to connect actually and, you know, say, oh, here's another book coming. And I'm actually kind of thinking, Pamela and I have been talking about whether we continue to do that. Even if it's not the kind of book that we normally review, like picture books and YA. But anyway, we'll have a think about that as we go. And let's just get past this pandemic.
And we are promoting not just middle grade books for that, for this time on social media. We are doing anything from picture books up to YA. So we're giving everyone a bit of love, and it's so nice to see there's so many authors online who are reading their books online or doing colouring in sheets and activities, and, you know, illustrators are doing drawing lessons, and there's so much out there. It's amazing.
It's kind of, it's woken up the industry a little bit, I think, as well.
I think a lot of people are learning new things.
Yes, and new technologies. Yep. So tell us, Pamela, what is the title of today's book?
So today I'm reviewing actually two books, the first of which is Derek Doole Super Cool Bust a Move, written by Adrian Beck and illustrated by Scott Edgar, published by Penguin Random House Australia under the Puffin Books imprint in March, so just last month, 2020.
Yes. And would you read the jacket blurb for us?
Yes. Think of the coolest, funniest, most handsome kid in school, times it by a gazillion, and you get Derek Dilbert Doole. At least he thinks so. Pity he's the only one. Life's tough when your name's Derek. You're destined to be uncool. But Derek is determined to find something, anything that will make him super cool? Could the answer be a winning a dance-off against the arch enemy at the upcoming school disco?
Oh, that sounds so great. And what genre would you class this as?
As you can guess, it's funny junior fiction.
Yep. And what is the estimated word count?
Oh, I think I nearly forgot to do this. I think it's around 20,000.
Yes.
With quite a few illustrations in there. Yeah.
Yep. And what drew you to this book?
So I've known Adrian around the traps and at conferences and things like that for a while. So when he posted this on social media, I knew immediately that Joke Boy, my 7-year-old, would love it. So I requested it, and Joke Boy did love it.
Of course, of course. Yeah, Adrian's a barrel of laughs, and he's a great children's book advocate. So yeah, we were very excited when this one came in the post.
Yeah,
so tell
absolutely.
Us about it.
So Derek Dool thinks he's super cool and he wants to prove it to everybody, especially his arch enemy, Carmichael Cruz. Now, how's that for an arch enemy surname?
That's a great name.
And the perfect opportunity is here, the school dance. He decides that he will wow everybody with his super cool dance moves, but the stakes rise when Carmichael Cruz challenges him to a dance-off. Unfortunately, Derek has only one move, the worm. And that's not going to win him any prizes. Derek's two friends, Booger and Big Denise, come up with a plan to help Derek win the competition. But as usual with Derek, nothing seems to go right. Instead, he ends up rescuing Booger's pet bunny, Sunny, and causing even more mayhem than usual.
Mm.
There are themes of sticking up for your friends and being true to yourself in this hilarious story with some very interesting characters. I've got the interview with Adrian coming up towards the end of this episode, so you'll hear a bit more about it there.
Yay, yep. And overall enjoyment?
Well, as I mentioned, Joke Boy wanted it and he got it and he read it first and immediately gave it the thumbs up. So that's always good to know that the kids Yay. Are loving it, right?
Yep.
Yeah, and I agree. It's very funny and fast-paced with lots of tension, mainly created by Derek himself.
Yep.
He's kind of his own worst enemy, really. There are some great inserts like Derek's friends' backstories and two crows who watch over everything, which,
oh,
yeah,
that is
I'm
so
not sure.
Muppets, isn't it?
It really is. I don't know if this is going to – I didn't actually ask Adrian about these two crows, but I'm interested to see how they come up in the future books. It's quite funny. And then, of course, the bad dad jokes littered throughout, which are very
of
funny.
Of course.
I think. Yeah, and I'm sure I've heard many of them before, the bad dad jokes, possibly from my own dad, but, yeah, you'll hear more about that as well in the interview.
Yep.
And I have to mention the great illustrations by Scott Edgar. They're very clean and full of energy and sass. So yeah, big thumbs up.
Oh, big thumbs up. And who will love this book? What age would you recommend it for?
Yeah, look, it's classic Adrian, really. It's fast-paced, it's easy to read and packed with humour. So I think perfect for 7 to 9-year-olds.
Yeah. And do you think reluctant readers would enjoy this, or is it for more confident readers?
Yeah, I think I was discussing with Adrian, it's kind of his sweet spot, reluctant readers. He really, you know, with the humour and the pacing, he really writes well for reluctant readers. So,
yeah,
definitely won this one.
Brilliant. Congratulations, Adrian and Scott, on a great book.
Yeah, so we look forward to the next one. Off the top of my head, I forget what it's called now. But, definitely looking forward to that one. And I'm looking forward to your review, Julie, because this is I haven't actually got my hands on it yet, but I mean, if you haven't been listening to this podcast, or if you have been listening to this podcast in the past, you will know how much I love Emily Rodda's work.
Yes.
But I also love Lucinda Gifford.
Yes.
And she's a friend. So, like, oh my gosh. So please, Julie, don't keep us in suspense. Tell us the title of today's book.
Okay, Monty's Island, Scary Mary and the Striped Spell by Emily Rodda, illustrated by Lucinda Gifford, published by Allen and Unwin on the 31st of March 2020. So yesterday, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. And so funny because I got this in the post and I said to Pamela, oh my goodness, I've got this book. And she was like, what? No fair. And I was like, well, I'm not double posting it. I'm just going to read it, review it myself. So, I have to make a confession. I have never read an Emily Rodda book.
Shame on you, Julie.
I know you're a massive fan, but I now have read an Emily Rodda book, and she's so brilliant. Anyway, of course, Lucinda Gifford is a friend of ours, and as soon as I got it, I was like, oh, we have to do an interview as well. So yeah, anyway,
I will get to it very soon. As soon as I can get out, or, you know, we've got books coming in anyway at the moment. It's crazy.
Yes.
Even
yes.
During a pandemic, we've still got books arriving on the doorstep because I've ordered them, or, you know, the kids have requested them, or, but we will, I will get to this one because, yeah. And this is something different for Emily, for Jennifer is her real name. But so I'm really interested to read it. But anyway, please. Keep us in suspense. Read the back jacket blurb for us.
Yep. On a tiny island far away, a sea that ripples with magic. Monty never knows what he might find. Monty, Tawny and friends receive some startling news. Scary Mary and her pirate crew are on their way, looking for a new island to call home. What can they do? There's no way they can hide, especially when Bunchy accidentally turns the whole island stripy with her new magic wand. It's going to take one of Monty's best ideas ever to save them. An adventurous and delightful new series from beloved author Emily Rodda.
Mm, it sounds so charming.
Oh, it is so charming. Like, yep.
Such a good writer too. So what genre would you class it as?
This is a junior fiction fantasy, I would say. And I don't know, we kind of, the stars aligned and we both have done a junior fiction without really trying. So,
well, I've got this, another one. There's a third junior fiction coming up. So it's like a junior fiction episode today.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So, yep.
So being a junior fiction, what's the word count, do you think?
I've said 15,000, but I think it might even be a little bit more, maybe up to 20, but... you know, we are so terrible at actually knowing, like, counting the words.
So, it's so hard when there's illustrations. Some of them are full page, some are half page.
I know, and I think people don't seem to worry so much, but I like to know the word count, so I'm not giving it up. So
well, it is interesting because, you know, some junior fiction, I mean, as I did the League of Llamas, it was last episode, yeah. And you know, they're junior fiction and they're fairly short, but they're not really young, you know, it is interesting to know. And I think particularly for the writers who listen, like, they like to know, like, yes. Where should I be pitching this at, what sort of word count should it be?
Yeah, so, of course,
yeah, still good to talk about. So well, you know, it's kind of needless to ask, but I'm gonna ask it anyway. What drew you to this book?
Well, of course, because it is one of our duckies, Lucinda Gifford, and it was sent to me by Allen and Unwin, and I was excited because I heard this was in the wings for Lucinda, and I just sort of thought, oh, I wonder when that's coming out, and then it arrived, and I was like, oh, my gosh, and then, of course, it's 100% delightful and true Lucinda Gifford style, so, yep.
She's got a great style. I love her style. I've got a few of her picture books, actually. And Lucinda's book, The Chicken Divas, was...
It's going to be a simultaneous story time.
Story time book, yeah.
Yeah.
So can you tell us more about this book?
Yeah. So Monty's Island is a place you'll want to visit and never go home again. There's much to entertain, from the argue birds that wake you in the morning to Clink the pirate parrot always hiding his treasure and sending rescue notes in bottles out to sea. Monty and his best friend, Tawny the Lion, don't let too much worry them until Bunchy, their magician friend, has a mishap with a spell turning them all into stripes. That wouldn't be such a problem. Surely they would figure out a way to fix it if it wasn't for a notorious pirate, Scary Mary, making sail towards their island. Everyone is thrown into total chaos, and even Marigold, the clever cook, who normally takes everything in her stride, and Sir Silent Wise the Owl are not sure what to make of the oncoming chaos. Rest assured, there is mayhem aplenty, and Monty and friends will have to band together to defeat the dreaded Scary Mary and her pirate cronies, or risk their island being overrun forever.
So good. It sounds like a real, like a sort of a light pirate story.
Yes, a rollicking good time.
Yeah. Oh, if anyone can do that well, that would be Emily Rodda.
Yeah, yeah.
So, enjoyment, please.
Oh, this was clever, fun, and captivating from the get-go. Emily Rodda draws you into the story with Monty and friends, giving us little snippets of their characters and their day until imminent chaos approaches. The pirates were piratey and Monty's friends were quirky, making this so much fun. The author plants little seeds for the solution all the way from the beginning of the story, and when it comes to fruition, it ends in a highly satisfying solution. I don't think I've ever read a story in a long time where I smiled almost through every single page. The illustrations by Lucinda Gifford are absolutely wonderful, and I could not wait to turn each page to see what she had conjured next.
Nice. And who will love this book? What age range do you think?
I think 7 to 9, if you want a bit of fantasy wrapped in a deliciously illustrated package.
And do you think for confident or reluctant readers?
I think this would suit both confident and reluctant, to be honest. Yeah, it was just so well written. I can see why you're a massive fan. And I can see she has been at this for a long time because it was just so seamless. And, you know, one of those, oh, wish I could write like that. But anyway.
She's amazing. And her book that I reviewed a couple of months back now, The Glim, actually, it's just recently shortlisted for the CBCA's
book of the year.
So well done, Emily Rodda. Yeah, definitely. Yep. And I think I also did reviewed her book, His Name Was Walter.
His Name Was Walter, yeah.
That works really well. So definitely one to pick up.
Yep. So, Pamela, what is your second review for today?
So I have to laugh at this because, as I said, this is a third junior fiction, and this book arrived on my doorstep, and straight away I thought this should have gone to Julie.
I know.
Because it's the hotel.
I am so desperately jealous.
So when we can finally get to the post office again, I think we're going to have postage Swap crossing paths.
Yeah.
Well, unless, of course, unless you want to keep Monty's Island. So this is the very cute Hotel Flamingo Carnival Caper, which is the third Hotel Flamingo book by Alex Milway and illustrated by Alex Milway, actually. And published by Piccadilly Press in 2018. It's a fairly recent book, though. It's the latest one. And I think there's a fourth book coming out soon. So, I had to laugh because Julie, as we know, is a big fan of books set in hotels.
Hotels. give me all the hotels. I'm so jealous. Anyway. So would you read the jacket blurb for us?
Sure. Hotel Flamingo. Everyone is welcome. It's carnival time on Animal Boulevard and Hotel Flamingo is all set to join the party. But Anna and her team have their work cut out when the Nocturnal Animals come to stay, the biggest rock group on the planet. Can Anna keep every guest happy and still make the biggest splash at the carnival?
Oh, it just sounds adorable.
Yeah.
And what genre would you class this as?
It's hard to say. I racked my brain over this. It's the upper end of junior fiction, but it doesn't fit comfortably into any particular genre. It's not contemporary or humour. So let's say it's anthropomorphic animals set in a hotel.
Another genre bender.
Genre bender? Maybe hotel books should be a genre. I don't know.
I totally think they should be.
I knew you would.
And what is the estimated word count?
At a guess, it's about 10,000 words with lots of lovely illustrations to break it up.
Oh,
Maybe, might be a bit
nice.
over that, but yeah.
And what drew you to this book?
I think I already mentioned that this arrived on my doorstep unannounced,
Yep.
but it was looking utterly enticing and colourful and fun. I mean, have you seen that glorious cover?
Yes.
I don't pretend to know much about printing and cover design, but you know how they do the metallic accents over the top of
Yep.
things, like
Yep.
shiny? This one has dark pink metallic accents down the left, and then it's all sort of on, well, and it's flowers and flamingos, and it's all sort of on top of this very colourful illustration of the carnival float that's in the
Yep.
story.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I just looked at it and went, wow, it's so fun.
Yeah,
Yeah,
it's
so
adorable. Got
big
to get my
tick for the
hands on it.
Yes, it's in it. You know what? It's actually in a padded bag, waiting to go to the post office to come to you
Fantastic. So
without any worry. Yeah.
tell us about it.
Yep. So this is the third book in the Hotel Flamingo series, which is about, as you can guess, a hotel run by a girl named Anna with the help of T-Bear and Lemmy the Lemur. I think the first book in the story is describes how this all comes about, so it's probably best to start with that, but I haven't read that one yet. But in this book there's a street carnival, and Anna has a week to prepare the float for her hotel, and then some interesting nocturnal guests arrive at the hotel. There's a skunk couple. The husband has a very nervous disposition, which you know what skunks do.
Right. Yeah.
He clears out the room pretty quickly.
Yep.
And a famous rock group called the Nocturnal Animals, whose cranky band manager makes them practice at night, which doesn't go down well with the other guests. And then through a stroke of luck, a new room is discovered under the hotel, a ballroom, which makes a perfect place for the band to practice. But the cranky manager goes a step too far, and Anna stands up to him, which inspires the rest of the band to also step up to him, so he quits. And then
Oh.
trouble deepens when an unusual storm is forecast for the day of the carnival, and the band manager finds a different band to perform at the carnival.
Oh.
He rejects the nocturnal animals. It's quite a complicated plot for a junior fiction, and so I won't tell you
No,
the rest of
don't
it.
tell me because I have to read it.
I have to read it. But there you have the main elements that come together in the climax. And yeah, it comes together really well.
Oh. I have to have it. And overall enjoyment.
It's, as you can tell, it's such a charming little book, and I would have loved this as a kid. And it kind of reminds me of Paddington for some reason. Maybe it's the
Yep.
Britishness about it, I don't know.
Yep.
And I don't think you don't see a lot of anthropomorphic animals in junior fiction these days.
No.
Let's not forget the llama book that I just reviewed not that long ago.
And the real pigeons. But anyway, yep,
And
keep going.
yeah, but I don't know. But those are more humor. I think the anthropomorphic animals tend to be more with the humor books. This is
Yeah.
not humor. I mean,
Okay.
there are some funny moments, but it's not meant to be humorous. It's not a humor book. But it does have this sort of British charm about it.
Yep.
And I love how the main character Anna, who's actually a girl, stands up to this big mean band manager who's a bear.
Yep.
And and she's so kind and inclusive, and she's a real sort of role model, I guess, for girls. And yeah, and the illustrations are so great. The setting of this flamingo themed grand hotel just calls for some
Yes.
beautiful backdrops, and I know you're gonna love it, Julie.
Yes. I may want to go and live there. That's my trouble.
Yeah, could be.
And who will love this book? What age would you recommend it for?
It's aimed at 5+. I think it would be perfect as a read aloud for that age.
Yep.
Yeah, for the younger kids, and I think it's a great book for younger children who are strong readers as well. It's quite mild in themes. But yeah, I think it suits girls and boys alike, even though it's pinkish It's not a girlish book in terms of story, themes in the story, if you know what I mean. So
yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
So do you think reluctant readers would enjoy this book, or is it for more confident readers?
Yeah, I think it would suit reluctant readers. It's not a heavy read, but it's not too young either. And yeah, the fourth book is coming out soon. I think it's in the next couple of months. So so you've got this year, you know, always with reluctant readers, you know, I know it's great once they latch onto a book, they want more of the same. So it's great to have a series for that.
I think I'll have to get requesting at the library when the library returns to full functioning. But
well, you can get the first two and I'll send you this one.
that's good. Well, that is it for our reviews, but don't run away, folks, as we have two fantastic interviews, first with Adrian Beck, then with Lucinda Gifford, and we hope you enjoy.
Yes, and keep your eyes peeled for our bonus episode soon.
Yes, coming soon.
Adrian Beck is the author of the Kick It to Nick series, a collaboration with AFL Hall of Famer Shane Crawford, Dale in the Stuff Happened series, and the Champion Charlie series. He is also co-editor of the Total Quack Up series with Sally Rippon and a TV producer having worked on such shows as The Footy Show, The Logie Awards, Carols by Candlelight, Prank Patrol, and Kids WB. Adrian's latest book, Derek Dool's Super Cool Bust a Move, is out now, and he's here with me today to have a little chat about this fun new junior fiction series. Welcome to Middle Grade Mavens, Adrian.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm a long-time listener, first-time interviewee.
Aha, well, we're so glad to have you on finally.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So Derek Dool Super Cool is the name of the series, and that's quite a mouthful, but it's essentially about a kid who wants to prove his coolness despite the fact that he's totally not. Can you tell us how this series came about?
Oh, look, there's a lot of what... influences on why this series came about, but I guess one of the main ones was obviously it's inspired by me as a kid, and I had some moments where I wasn't as cool as perhaps I could have been, including I did a whole bunch of silly things, like there's a moment in the book where Derek puts Christmas lights, fairy lights in his hair and wears that to the school disco. That's actually something I did myself, and I'm not proud of that. But I did try, and that was one way I tried to be cool. There's many ways I tried to be cool. I started a rock band, and I couldn't, well, none of us could play instruments. And I tried to become one of the rowers at one point, but I actually slipped off the jetty before I even got in the boat, and I quit before I even got in the boat. I mean, I tried just about everything at school to try and be cool in hindsight, and not a lot of it worked, I have to be honest. So that's kind of where the idea came from. But there's a couple of influences. One of them was, you mentioned before that I work in TV, and we were actually interviewing Andy Griffiths at his place for one of our segments, and we actually went to where he does his writing. Now, he said, come on up to the treehouse, and we thought, oh yeah, you know, he's just being hilarious, Andy. But we walk in and it's decorated, it seriously looked like his back, I want to call it like a bungalow type thing, was like decorated like it was something from his actual series, The Treehouse. There were jars full of you know, dolls, you know, strange sort of dolls that had been assembled in, you know, different legs and arms in different spots and all this sort of stuff. And then there was toys from all, you know, all sorts of strange toys, lots of slimy, gross things. There was actual sort of like a to scale model of the treehouse. There was a skeleton. There was just things hanging off the roof. It was like, it was really incredible. And it sort of suddenly dawned on me, even though I'd written a number of books at that stage, this wasn't long ago, it suddenly dawned on me that this guy, Andy, who's so successful, he lives his whole series while he's writing it. And I thought, I've never really done that. I've just sort of, you know, grabbed my laptop and whacked it onto the kitchen table. Once everyone else in the house has gone to bed, I just sort of started to tap away and, you know, was fueled on coffee. And I thought, what would happen if I actually really tried to, I don't know, immerse myself and disappear into whatever I was writing, the way that Andy clearly does when he's writing. And that all those thoughts were swirling around at the time. And I noticed that he's got quite an impressive music collection. And I said, do you listen to music when you write? And he goes, absolutely, all the time. And so I went home and I thought, okay, what's the sort of series I want to write? This was just before I came up with the Derek Dool idea. And I thought, well, I want to write something wacky, but I also want to write something with a lot of energy. So I came up with this playlist, and I had pretty much Madness, who are kind of like a fun, wacky UK band from the 80s, and the Beastie Boys as well. And so I grabbed these two slightly different genres, you might say, a lot of energy, a lot of silly wackiness, and sort of kept that playing on repeat until I was tapping out an idea I was happy with. And at the same time, I thought to myself, I do a lot of second guessing up until that point anyway. I was thinking, you know, will the publishers like this? Will the publishers like that? I guess a lot of us do that. I was doing that. And I thought to myself, when I was in that zone, I thought, I don't really care who's going to like this. So I'm just going to write what I like. And then of course you have in the back of your mind, I'll fix it up at some point if I'm ever going to send it anywhere. But I just sort of smashed it out and bashed out the most wild and energetic and wacky idea I could think of at the time. And it turned out to be, you know, as I said, inspired by myself as a kid. And that's sort of what came out of it. And I think I got to about 10 chapters before I went back and tweaked with it and, you know, did any finessing. And I thought, oh, I've actually got an idea here. This might actually be worth pursuing. And so for the whole duration of writing the first book, the Bust a Move book, that's exactly how I wrote it. I tried to put all those voices aside, all those, oh, will they like this? Oh, will kids like that? I just thought, I'm going to write something that I think is fun and exciting and silly. And then, you know, I can always fix it up later. And the beauty of freeing yourself up like that is that, you know, you actually, you know, writer's block sort of goes away a touch, which is good. And also what comes out on the page, it's more concentrated, I think. And so there was a mixture of things that got us to Derek Dool, but I think that was a very fortuitous occasion that I ran into Andy on that day and was inspired. I don't think he even knew that I was inspired, but I was looking around and I thought, this is an amazing way to write. I wonder if I could take an element of that.
Wow, that's a great story. I love that you're inspired by Andy Griffiths. I mean, he's been doing it for so long. I mean, that series is what, 10, 30, I don't even know how many years that's been going for.
Yeah. It's hugely successful. But it's clearly it taps into his personality in you know, quite a real and vivid way. And I just thought, I wonder if I could do that. And so that's what I tried to do. And obviously, you know, there are only a few similarities between the two series. But I was just trying to get into that same zone that I assumed that's what he did when he wrote. So, that's sort of where it came from.
Yeah. I can't imagine writing with music on. I would get way too distracted. Well, it's great that you tried something different. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I often do write with music on, but I it depends on what I'm writing. Sometimes I'll go for the smooth sort of 70s classics, you know, that sort of stuff that I used to listen to in the back of the car when Dad was driving us around, you know, when I was a kid. And you can sort of tune that out, but it still sort of keeps you company, if you like. But with this one, it became much more of a companion as I was writing. And you can see, I think you can see in the book some of those influences, because all of a sudden one of our characters is, you know, raps all the way through the book, Beastie Boys style. And it's just a lot of fun and stuff that I've thrown in there, which perhaps I wouldn't have if I hadn't have approached it in that way.
Yeah, it's a lot. I can tell there's a lot of energy in it. It's full of energy. And the rapping is fantastic. I love it.
And the beauty of the rapping is it's basically poetry. You know, kids are actually reading poetry and they don't even realize it. That's what I love about it. That's what I love revealing at schools, that they've just read a poem.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I mean, it's great to continue because, you know, when they are younger and they're reading picture books, they get a lot of rhyming, you know, and that really helps them with so many things, with learning to read and with rhythm and with music and, you know, with just slip of language. And then they move on to, you know, more advanced stuff. And then they're not really, unless they're doing poetry at school or something, they're not really doing a lot of rhyming. So it's good to have that in there and to bring it back and to bring it in a cool way as well.
Yeah, absolutely. A super cool way. But we we do sort of, we've been doing some rap battles with the kids when we've been going to schools, which is a lot of fun. So we hope to do some more of that later in the year because, yeah, as you say, it does get them thinking in terms of rhymings and things like that, which sometimes they sort of move away from a little bit as they get older. But also it's just so theatrical and it's just, you know, it's just gets them up off the floor, moving about, you know, doing poses and things like that. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it'd be, I guess it would be great to use that for school visits. You know, I think they can kind of be quite hard to do with a younger audience. So having been able to get them moving and having fun is a great way to get them interested in the book as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, it's quite a relatable concept for the kids too, because there's a lot of kids there that are, you know, having similar thoughts about, oh, is it cool to do this or is it cool to play footy or is it cool to, you know, do the chess club and all that sort of stuff. And ultimately the theme is more about the fact that, you know, you don't have to try to be cool. Being cool is just being you, really. And so we sort of do that. We sort of get that message out in a subtle way. And I think Derek will learn that message as the series continues. It's kind of, it's very relatable to the kids that are listening in those school visits, which helps us a lot because, you know, sometimes it's hard to capture their attention when you're doing these school visits. Yeah. So it's good to have a few tricks like that up your sleeve.
Yeah. And that actually moves into what my next question was going to be, because I love that at the end of the book, the underlying message is that there are more important things than trying to be cool, but you know, Derek didn't actually seem to get it, which paves the way for another book. So how many books will it take for Derek to stop trying to be cool?
A million. Right. I reckon. Derek, it's a little bit of a balancing act because you kind of want to do the Simpsons thing where you end up, you know, right where you began with all your character arcs, and you want them to be sort of, you know, as soon as you get to the next book, you kind of, in some ways, you'd like it to be a blank slate and they have their new adventure all over again and they don't really learn anything and they have, you know, they make a lot of similar mistakes and everyone laughs and then it's like roll the credits. But you kind of, as simple as that sounds format-wise, it's hard to do. I personally find that hard to do because you're always trying to take these characters on a bit of a journey. I've found that I'm trying to slow down Derek's journey as much as possible because I want to get a lot of gags out of him and a lot of fun, you know, additions of the book, you know, lots of new adventures for him. So I've got to slow down his learning a fair bit. So he's you might notice in this book he learns a couple of lessons, but he's not going to learn it all at once. Whereas we're following his best friends who are being themselves and have their own interests and skills, and they're not as obsessed as he is about being seen as cool. And hopefully that contrast starts to come through as the series progresses.
Yeah, and I can see that those two main supporting characters, Derek's best friends, well, they're not really friends at the beginning, but they do have their own character arcs as well. So,
yeah, absolutely. And he sort of starts to, I mean, he's egotistical. I mean, he's basically based on, and this is, I've just drawn on all my loves, really, and he's basically based on Rick Mayall. So in The Young Ones, which I loved, Rick was hilarious in that. And then they went on to make a spin-off series, which wasn't as popular as The Young Ones, and it was called Bottom. And it was basically about Rick and Eddie in a share house. Rick Mayall played a character who was just completely egotistical, thought he was the best at everything he did, thought the world owed him something, thought he was, you know, devilishly handsome, all the rest of it. And I always thought that was hilarious, and the way he overreacts to everything. And I thought it would be great to try and take a hint of that as a kid. What would that character be like as a kid? Then throw a bit of, you know, a little bit of me in there as well. And so that's where Derek really comes from. The actual character of Derek is probably a mixture of me and, you know, that sort of Young Ones humor, I'd say. And so, yeah, he just can't learn too quickly. That's our only challenge. He's got to keep making those silly mistakes so we all laugh.
So we get more books out of it.
He's definitely an anti-hero as well. Because I know that quite often in books you'll have characters that are obviously, you know, well-meaning and, you know, you don't want to go quite so far as to say that they're, you know, goody two-shoes, but they're certainly, most of them are fairly earnest and they mean well, which is great. And look, certainly when I'm reading books to my girls, that's exactly what I'm looking for. But I thought it might also be fun to flip that on its head a little bit. And I'm sure there's plenty like that, but there's not a lot, there's not heaps. So I thought it'd be fun to have him as an anti-hero. And I think it's pretty obvious for the kids reading that the way Derek acts is perhaps not the way they should be acting. And I kind of, the analogy I was making in my mind while I was writing it, it's a little bit like Pig the Pug, you know, more of a middle grade sort of audience, whereby, you know, all the kids that are reading Pig the Pug know that what he's doing is wrong and bad, and that Trevor's the good guy. And so there's a little bit of a similarity with Derek. Everything that Derek does, on some level he means well, but he goes about it in completely the wrong way. And I think kids get that. So he's definitely an anti-hero, but he's also got that contrast of his two best friends that are, you know, just totally lovable. And I think kids that read it will, you know, be able to make that judgment themselves, which is fun and interesting, hopefully, for them, something slightly different.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you mentioned Aaron Blaby, I think most of his books are anti-heroes. He's got the bad guys.
Yes.
Pig the Pug. I think I did read somewhere he did an interview and he was talking about how he loves doing anti-heroes. So, kids do know and they do get it. And we are massive Aaron Blaby fans here. So.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more opportunity for humour as well when you've got a character who's so flawed. When you've got a character who's always trying to do the right thing, that also brings with it some comedic possibilities. But I think it's, as a lazy writer like myself, it's easier if they're incredibly flawed, Basil Fawlty style, you know?
The gags are there. Yeah. So speaking of all this, my 7-year-old son read this before I had a chance and he kept running to tell me the bad dad jokes that are dotted around the book. So I knew most of them before I even read it. Tell me, where did these jokes come from and do you use them on your daughters?
Oh, absolutely. That's what dads are for, bad dad jokes. That's our main role, isn't it? yes, I do. They just think that it's normal because I'm always spouting off bad dad jokes. Look, I wanted to show that Derek's dad was a bit of a joker and that's where he gets his comedy from a little bit. So a good way of doing that was to drop through all the dad jokes that his dad has often told him, you know, over the years. And I thought that would be a fun way to include an extra few gags here and there, basically. And I crammed in all my favorites, basically. Did you have a favorite bad dad joke that you came across there? Are you a fan of bad dad jokes?
I think I had most of those from my dad, actually. off the top of my head, I can't remember any particular one. No. But my 7-year-old, he loves, like, this is just the right kind of book for him. He loves anti-heroes. He loves, you know, cheeky boys. He is a cheeky boy, I have to say. Right. So thanks for, you know, he doesn't learn anything bad from it. But he loves him.
That's great to hear. Yeah, well, hopefully he's committed a lot of those jokes to memory and he can fire off a few around the dining room table would be good.
Oh, he does. Don't worry, he does. He's making up his own now. He's making up his own jokes now. He needs to. So this is my son who has declared that he is going to be a comedian mathematician when he's grown up.
Oh,
so,
that's fantastic.
That's awesome.
We need more comedian mathematicians.
Yeah, I think there's enough.
There's a good niche that he's got there. That's good.
Yeah, I think so. He's got to work harder, though. So the illustrations by Scott Egger are a hoot. Yes. I love the way he portrays Derek. Did you get to work closely with Scott to work on Derek's look or was that all his idea?
Yeah, we did. The funny thing with Scott is that he lives in the same street as me.
No way.
we didn't really know each other, but I sort of recognised, like we'd go to the local coffee shop and I'd recognise him because he's a member of the band Tripod, the comedy band Tripod. And I sort of knew his face. So I would be in the cafe and I thought, I know that guy from somewhere. But then it twigged on who it was. And eventually we did meet, obviously, and, you know, had a few chats here and there. And then when Penguin said, have you got any ideas on who you'd like to illustrate it? And I thought, yes, absolutely do I have ideas. I want to get Scott Edgar to do it. And so I shot back an email straight away saying, Scott Edgar's the man. He's got to do it. You know, he's got the right vibe. He'll make it, he gets the gags. It'll be great. And like, you know, most of the time when I suggest stuff to publishers, they're like, okay, terrific, leave it with us. And then I never hear anything about it ever again. But in this case, it was completely different because I suggested that. And then the very next day they said, oh, we've contacted Scott. He's bang up for it. We're all go. And I thought, oh, that's fantastic. So it was great to have him on board. And basically, in working out what Derek looked like, that was his hardest challenge, working out what Derek was to look like. Because you read the book, if you were reading the book without any illustrations, you would probably draw Derek, you know, even more wild and crazy than he actually appears on the front cover. So we had to sort of tone it back a little bit so that, you know, it's all about the cover. So that when kids pick it up, they don't like, oh, gee, he looks like a strange fellow. We had to try and make him seem a little bit more approachable. So there was a bit of a process with that. Scott likes to think that I wanted him to look like me. And Scott likes to say that I kept saying, make him more handsome, make him more handsome. But I don't remember ever saying handsome. But he likes to think that's what we were trying to go for. So he went through about 20 different versions before we got to the Derek that we're all happy with. And obviously the publishers have a huge amount of say in that. And yeah, he didn't really change a whole, there was just a lot of tweaks along the way. And we just wanted to make him, look cheeky, but not full on evil. So that when kids saw it, they'd be like, oh yeah, he looks like fun, as opposed to, oh my gosh, he looks like some sort of supervillain. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. He kind of looks like, you know, someone that they might want to be friends with.
Yes.
But, you know, it'd be fun. Yeah.
It's a fine balance, that.
I think it's a great job. I think the cover, you know, Julie and I quite often talk about how important the cover is, particularly for kids. And it looks really fresh and, you know, it's not overcluttered and it just has this, you know, this cheeky kid on the front. That's great.
Yeah, well, you know, that's interesting actually because I was talking to Holly, the publisher, and she was saying, you know, what colour do you want on the back? And I said, oh, I don't know. Well, let's have a think about it. And then I went into a bookstore and I looked around at all the all the books because she'd said to me that very morning, she said, how do you feel about white? I said to her, white, that's not actually, you know, that's not really a colour, is it, Holly? You know, what's going on there? And she's like, I really think it would stand out. So I went to a bookstore and I looked at all the books that were on the shelf, all the face-out books. And at that stage, there was hardly any white books. And I said, I went back to Holly and I said, look, let's give it a go. Let's give white a go. And so that's how we've ended up with a white background, which is a little unusual, but it does make it all, Derek, the drawing stand out and the title stand out. So yeah, I think she was bang on the money there.
Yeah, it's a great idea. I think it might not be so much now, but there was a period of time where every second book was blue. So.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
yeah,
the blue period. So going back to your writing and how you wrote this, how, if at all, does your work in television influence your writing? Because, you know, television is such a visual medium, but it's still storytelling. And you were talking about sort of trying to finish up a book that the character hasn't grown too much and there's, you know, scope for more. And that sounds like, to me, that sounds like it's been influenced a little bit by your TV work. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's funny. The TV world and the publishing world are poles apart in many ways. And one of those ways is the turnaround, because we would in working TV, sometimes you need to get a segment up for that night, which you're shooting in the afternoon, that goes to air that night. So you don't have the luxury of, you know, finessing and thinking about, you know, this angle and that angle and you know, in some ways, it trains you to go with your gut and not to second guess yourself too much. And so what I still find really hard about publishing is just how long everything takes. Like, this was from the first idea being sent through, it was like 2.5 years or something. It was like, and that seemed like an eternity to me. It's just probably reasonably average for most people. So, but that seemed like a long time. But so I find the pace that it moves quite different. But in terms of bringing what I feel like I've brought from TV is that, you know, sometimes a lot of these books can take themselves pretty seriously, whereas I wanted to make something that was, you know, a lot of fun. I wanted to pack it full of fun, pack it full of impact, and, you know, make it pacey. And I see the whole story as either a cartoon or a film in my mind. And so it's just a matter of trying to, you know, capture that in with the words. And oftentimes that means that I've got a lot of dialogue and I've got a lot of talking heads and I need to step back and think to myself, okay, I'm following all this like it's some sort of, you know, elaborate, you know, movie, but I need to make sure that I'm adding in the descriptors and making sure I'm painting the picture and, you know, where everyone's standing and, you know, what the room looks like and all that sort of stuff. You know, that comes in the second pass for me because I'm always trying to think of the funny lines and the banter and, you know, a lot of the slapstick, you know, visual humor as well. So I think that's probably the main difference is I'm trying to think of impactful, funny gags and also funny lines. And that's definitely my focus initially. And then I take a step back.
Yeah, definitely sounds like a very visual way of writing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just can't think of it any other way, to be honest. I have to... Whenever I'm thinking about the third act in the books, I'm constantly thinking about, okay, how do I wow them in the third act? You know, like it's the end of a movie type thing. And so I'm always trying to go bigger and bigger and bigger and do something, you know, really visual and imaginative. And I reckon that's definitely comes from thinking visually and coming from TV for sure.
Yeah. No, that's different from how I write.
Is it? How do you do it?
Well, I'm such a reader, so I'm always sort of in the head of the character, and I think in words. Yeah. I mean, I see pictures in my head, but I think in words, and I think more in feelings. I think as well.
Yeah.
So that coming at it from a sort of three act structure and a visual, I've learned that over time, but that wasn't, you know, how I started. No.
Isn't that interesting? See, I've got to go back sometimes and ensure that I've got those bits and pieces that they're all there as well because I'm so focused on the other. But it's just so interesting how everyone's got a different way of attacking it.
Different, yeah. I mean, like, you know, I did a course recently, and a lot of people were like, "Oh, I have trouble with, you know, dialogue or descriptors." And I'm like, I'm fine with that. For me, it's figuring out the plot and the structure and, you know, like it's that whole storytelling side of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, everyone has their strengths and weaknesses, of course.
Well, that's another thing is that I always plan out my stories before I write them. And I think that's partly because I'm so time poor. But also, I can't waste too much time going down too many dead ends, even though, you know, that might lead to something amazing, you know, every one out of 10. So I do plot out everything that I do. And I think that helps with structure. And I find it really interesting when people say they pants it. And I in some ways I'm envious because it feels like they're able to sit there and just sort of, you know, find where the breeze is blowing and where it's taking them. And I'm envious of that, but I've never been able to do that. I have to have a basic plan, which, you know, is sort of details chapter by chapter. And there's plenty of room to move once I'm in that plan and I'm writing. But I have to have a backbone to what I'm doing before I can actually get going. And that was why it was strange when I first started writing Derek Dool is that I just sat down and wrote the first few chapters without a plan. But and then when I thought maybe I'm onto something here, that's when I went back and did a plan for the rest of it.
Right. And for those listening along who don't know the jargon, pantsing is flying by the seat of your pants, basically just writing without having a plot already thought out or a plan. And that's basically how I work. I start with pantsing, and then eventually I go, right, I need to actually figure out where this is going. And so then I start planning. So so there are people who are pantsers and people who are plotters, and then people who are plotsers or plantsers or somewhere in between. Proper. And so I know you do, you were speaking before, you do a lot of school visits. And does your television background also influence what you do with your school visits?
Oh, 100%. Probably that's the area that's most influenced by my TV background, because I try and come at them from a million different angles. Because, the funny thing is, because I've written a lot of sporty books and I've written a lot of funny books. So you have schools which think to themselves, okay, we need to reach these reluctant readers a little bit here. So I find myself going to a lot of schools where, there's a lot of wiggling and there's a lot of chatter and there's a lot of, there's a lot of kids that, are falling asleep on each other's shoulders. And so, I don't know whether I've made a rod for my own back somehow, really. But anyway, I do find myself at a whole gamut of schools. So I throw in all sorts of different things into my presentation. So I have lots of visual gags. I have lots of videos that I throw to. I use music a lot. So I'll use almost like when we're doing I've got this thing called a Wheel of Derek, which is basically a Wheel of Fortune ripoff. So whenever I go to that slide, the Wheel of Derek theme starts playing, and then a kid can come up and I've got a prop which relates to the Wheel of Derek, and they can spin the wheel, and then, whatever it comes up with, that's what our next little bit will be. So it kind of feels really interactive. And I try and get the kids up regularly. Like I'll have the kid up every 10 minutes, basically. And if I don't have a kid up every 10 minutes, then, I feel like perhaps I've been talking too long. So I really try and involve them and make it interactive, make it fun, and come at them from a whole different angle. So we've got music and dancing. We've got dance-offs. We've got rapping. I'm finishing with rap battle these days, which is a lot of fun, especially when you set up kids to say rude words. Nothing terribly rude, but things like bum and stuff like that. And they always get a kick out of that. I've got a lot of props too. So that, I know how to dress things up, which is a really handy trick. So, when they do their rap battle, I've got the bling and the caps they can wear backwards and all that sort of stuff. So it's just making the moments just that slightly, making more of these moments slightly more than they really are, really. It's just, a bit of that old fashioned showbiz, really. So the school presentations, I like to think of them, they're a bit like putting on a bit of a show.
Yeah. I guess, you are writing books that sort of do hit that reluctant reader target market. And then during the school visits, do you then hear from the teachers that they've had success getting the kids to read?
Yeah, I do. The funny thing is I find myself working pretty hard in these sessions. And so at the end of it, I'm completely exhausted. But it is great when you hear from the teachers saying, we reached little Johnny who's hasn't picked up a book in 3 years and now he's finally wanting to read your book, and that's fantastic. So when you hear those stories, and I'm fortunate enough to hear those stories, quite regularly, which is really heartening. So that's great. Mm. So I'm glad that it's having that effect and, getting up there and, basically making a fool of yourself for an hour actually gets kids interested in picking up books, which is great. That's why I make a fool of myself. In all aspects.
Yeah. Well, that's what we want, isn't it? We want kids to read the books.
Absolutely.
And just sort of segueing a little bit, I heard recently and was, quite disappointed to hear about the axing of Kids WB and the reluctance of the mainstream networks to create new Australian content for children. Do you think there'll be more children's television work on the horizon, or, for you, or do you think it's going to start dying out?
I love kids TV. Absolutely. I mean, I've done this for so many years, and it's one of my favourite genres for sure. And I would love to do it again. It's just so tricky because the reality is that a lot of kids are watching, your streaming services these days. So the audience is shrinking, and that's a challenge. So what I would love to see, and you know, I'm sure there are plenty of people that are putting a lot more thought into it than I am, but I would love to see quotas for the streaming services. So they have to make a certain amount of Australian content for kids so that it's, kids aren't just sitting there watching all this American stuff, you know, and there's plenty of great American stuff, but it's also great to reflect our own culture. So it shouldn't be that hard for kids to have to find something that reflects their own culture. It should be easy. It should be prominent. And if streaming is what, you know, streaming on YouTube or what kids are watching, if that is still accurate, then I think it would be great to see, you know, quotas for kids TV applying to the streaming services as well. And that hopefully that might happen in the future. But who knows? I mean, who knows? It's all so fragmented. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my kids don't really watch the American content. They actually watch the British content. And
yeah,
I think that's because they're so creative. Yes. You know, there's so much in them and they love all that. They love shows like Crystal Maze and they love Horrible Histories and those know, there's a lot of humour and gags and things like that.
And a budget, great, you know.
Of course.
I mean, you can actually see how much money they're putting into these shows. And I think most people can. I probably come at it from a slightly different angle because I'm a producer, but you can definitely see that there's been a lot of love that goes into these shows and there's been a lot of money spent on these shows. And that's why there is the quality's there. And, you know, I just hope that, you know, we can get to that point or continue trying to get to that point here in Australia, because there are some excellent kids shows from around the world and we can make them. We just need to invest in them.
Just have the money. And if you make, you know, great content, they'll come and you know, I mean, Blue is doing really well, obviously.
Exactly.
And it's, you know, by word of mouth, there's a lot of it. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, Bluey
made.
Hopefully Bluey is making a lot of people in powerful places think about the potential of kids TV in Australia. That would be my one hope, because Bluey is excellent.
Yeah. I haven't actually seen it. My kids are past that stage now, but I hear a lot about it.
No, you got to get onto it. You got to binge it. It's fantastic.
I know. I think I'm going to have to watch it just to see what it's all about. I just see so much about it, you know. Okay, Adrian, are you ready for our six quick questions?
Am I ready? Oh, I'm sweating. I think I'll be right.
Right. Keyboard or pen and paper?
Pen and paper.
Favorite writing snack?
Chocolate.
Good man. Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Ebook or the real thing?
The real thing.
Although at the moment you haven't got much choice, have we? cats or dogs?
Dogs. Very much dogs.
And comedy or tragedy? I think I know what you're going to say.
Comedy. Yeah. Comedy, but I like a little bit of tragic relief in comedy. So I like it all to be about comedy, and then you've got one or two chapters or a moment in a series you're watching where they actually pause for a moment and there's, they sort of have a real moment, a real sort of meaningful exchange or development. I think that is really, really powerful when it's, you know, couched in a comedic book or TV show. I think, tragic relief is very much underrated.
Heart, they call it. Heart.
Yes, what was heart it? As well, absolutely.
Heart, smart and heart.
Yes, well, I think that's Mick Elliott's great saying, isn't it? Heart, smart and fart. Yeah.
I don't know where I heard that. I think I heard that at a conference once ages ago and I don't know where it originally came from. So there you go.
Yeah. No, that's they're a great three elements to aspire to as well, for sure.
Yeah. So Derek Dool's super cool Buster Move is out now and the second book going viral is due out in August from all good bookstores and online. And please remember to support your local indie bookstore while we are in pandemic shutdown mode, which we currently are. Where can our listeners find you, Adrian, if they want to learn more?
I don't know how much they'll learn, Pamela, but they can certainly find me at Adrian Beck Books. So I'm Adrian Beck Books on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. And, you'll find me posting all sorts of inane rubbish and occasionally some tragic relief.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Adrian. It's been a pleasure and good luck with your upcoming Derek Dool books. We can't wait to see them.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Today on Middle Grade Mavens, I'm talking with Lucinda Gifford, illustrator of Monty's Island, Scary Mary and the Striped Spell by Emily Rodder, published by Allen and Unwin on March 31, 2020. We thought it would be awesome to invite Lucinda into the Middle Grade Mavens hot seat to get the inside skinny on developing the artwork. And guess what? She agreed. So hi, Lucinda, and thanks for joining us at Middle Grade Mavens.
Hi, Julie. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to having a good chat.
Nothing like a chin wag in the midst of a pandemic. So tell us, Lucinda, where did you get your start in illustrating?
Well, I've been drawing for a long time, but I suppose it was at Squibby 2014 when everything really got started. I didn't actually go to the conference, but I sent my folio for the portfolio showcase and it came back with lots of positive comments. And at the same time, I sent the same folio to Five Mile Press. They were running an illustrator prize at the time. And then it all kicked off. I won the illustrator prize, which was quite surprising, but really wonderful. And then the folio came back, like I said, and with all these names of publishers on it. So yeah. I went through working out what their email addresses were.
I love this.
And I was just plucking up the courage to send through some emails when Suzanne O'Sullivan from Achette called to see if I'd like to come up to Sydney. And they wanted to talk about the possibility of illustrating a book. At the same time, Five Mile Press were talking about this, but they also wanted me to write the book.
Ah.
So I had all this going on in my head. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to go up to Sydney, I should drop by these other publishers who seem to like my folio. So I emailed them to say, I'm coming up to Sydney. Should I drop by for a chat?
Yes.
So I dropped by Scholastic and Walker Books as well, who both said they might have work in the future. And while I was sitting in a restaurant thinking about all this, Omnibus Books called up out of the blue, completely different sort of, they hadn't seen my folio, but they'd seen something online and they wondered if I could illustrate a book cover.
So, oh, my gosh.
So within about 2 months, I had 4 contracts and I didn't really want to turn any of them down. So I just started working evenings and weekends to get them all done.
Because you would have had your other, you know, profession still going back then, wouldn't you?
I did. So I was working in an advertising agency part-time and I was also working in a studio for people with intellectual disabilities, a workshop. So I had to download those jobs. Yeah.
Yep. Wow. Yeah.
Full-time author and illustrator, which is wonderful.
And the thing about, like we hear so many authors, you know, they sort of got their start, you know, oh, when I was 2, I used to write all the words. And illustrators are such a different journey, aren't they? I mean, yes, if you're going to draw, you draw, but it might take a very long time to hone that. But it might take a really different approach to be actually taken notice of in the industry. And that's kind of what's happened to you. Like, you had a really unique style. Well, I personally think you do, because I'm a big fan of your work. So, and that uniqueness actually brought you forward instead of just being the cookie cutter, you know, line drawing.
Oh, that's great that you say that. I mean, I think that so I really like drawing, but really what inspires me to draw is story.
Yes.
So if I start, I sometimes think, okay, I could do a series of cards or something else with my drawings. And as soon as there isn't a story, I just lose interest so quickly.
Yeah.
So the illustrations were really a way of telling my stories.
Yeah. And
I think I thought my style varies quite a bit, but other people tell me that most of my characters, they're quite cohesive, you know, the whole style is quite cohesive. And I mean, I think they end up looking pretty goofy, really. I do use a lot of different techniques to get my stories across.
Yeah.
But yes, that's great to know I've got a style after all that. Sometimes
you
I think
do. And how many books have you had published now? Are there too many to count? And is there still a rush when you see a new book?
Oh yes, no, I love getting the books. I'm not very good at the unboxing videos, but I do unbox and squeal and wave them around and take them to school and show all my friends and give them to the librarian. Because I've illustrated on a few series now, I've actually lost count of the books worked on. And for Chuck Doolan, there were 8 books. Yep. And then there's the Cat Wants series. There are 3, and there is another one coming out soon.
Great.
And then there's the Princess Peony series. I think there's about 30.
Wow.
So that's pretty amazing since 2014.
Yes, it is. Yep.
Yeah. And I get nervous. I was going to say I also get nervous when the new books arrive because I have worked as a designer and art director before, and I'm terrified there'll be a mistake in them. So.
Yes, which does happen, and yeah, it almost makes the uniqueness even more unique, doesn't it?
As long as it's not a typo on the main cover, that's fine.
Yeah. Oh, it's so, yeah, heart in mouth. And so how did the contract for illustrating Emily Rodder's book come about?
Well, that was fairly standard, actually, in that the publisher, and in this case that was Eva Mills, head of children's publishing at Allen & Unwin, she approached my agent, Claire Forster, at Curtis Brown, and it went from there. So Claire just called me up and said, I've got some great news. And we never talked about the possibility of not doing that one.
Yes, never. Getting back to style, because I think you have a particular style, but what would you describe your particular style as, and what are your influences?
Well, I do think, as I said, my style's very dictated by the story and what it seems to demand.
Yeah.
So my influences, initially I thought I'd do the kind of work that Sean Tan does, because he was my first influence, and discovering his books in early 2000s, that was what really led me back to wanting to do drawing and illustration again. I'd always loved it. So I thought I'd do this deep, quirky, unsettling type of work.
Yep.
And to be honest, if someone gave me a sad or a spooky text to illustrate, I'd probably do something quite different to what I do now. Maybe with a few of those goofy eyes in the background.
Yeah.
So he was a huge influence. But now, because I am surrounded by all these books, there's so much to get excited by. So I love Vivian Schwartz's work. Do you know her?
Yes. Yep.
So she's German, but she lives in the UK, and she writes and illustrates, and she really follows her interests.
Yes.
So I love that. And she collaborates with Alexis Deacon, who also writes and illustrates and often does them separately. So she's illustrated a book he's written, for example. And also I love Emily Gravett. And her wit in the illustrations, the humour and warmth in them is really inspiring. And David Roberts, though I really prefer his black and white stuff, the real Edward Gorey influenced work.
Sure, yeah, yep.
I've just realised they're all British. Oops. I really like Gus Gordon and Ben Wood as well. Their work's so energetic and warm, and it seems loose, but it's pencil perfect. It's really, really thought through and works beautifully with the text.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of pencil perfect, talk us through your illustration process, because am I correct in saying you are still using textiles, or are you now doing both digital and textile?
So I always compile everything digitally. I've never sent artwork to the publisher to be scanned, for example. I do all that myself.
Yep.
But for each book, it would be very different. So I did one called Duck, Duck, Moose a while ago, and I drew all that in big black ink, which I love using.
Yeah.
And then I photographed the ink, and then I fiddled with it digitally. But it really, really varies project to project. I can talk you through what I do for Monty, but
let's talk through Monty.
Yeah. Well, it's actually quite a left brain process. I think a lot of people would be surprised by how organized you need to be as an illustrator, particularly for a chapter book like this.
Yes.
It's very structured. So the initial creativity comes in the character stages. And in the layout, I suppose, thinking about how to make it more exciting. But yeah, very structured. So I do a rough layout of the whole book first, and the text has to flow with the images. So this is what happens. I get the final text from Alan and Unwin, and I have to read it really thoroughly several times. And then I start marking in pencil the bits that I'd like to illustrate. So when I say I'd like, that's bits that excite me, but also this is for young readers. So they need to understand the action. So there are key characters or situations that we need to illustrate, and we need to make the environment really clear to them. So what happens after that is sometimes publishers give me a laid out text template with holes in it for the illustrators.
Right.
So see where they go. But for this one, Alan and Unwin let me decide how many illustrations I wanted and where to put them. And I actually really like that freedom, even though it is more work.
Yeah.
So their designer, Joe, has already decided on fonts and spacing and little flourishes and the number of lines per page. So I have a sort of design template. And then because of my graphic design background, I can recreate that loosely. And I paste it into InDesign, where I've created the template. And so it looks approximately like their design. And then I start making my own holes or gaps in the text for where I'd like the images to go. Is this clear or is this really?
Yes, I'm just so fascinated I can't speak.
It's really cool. And I mean, this is where digital technology saves a huge amount of time. I start creating the rough illustrations in Photoshop on my computer, and I place them as I go along. And that way I get a really good sense of what works with the flow. Really left brain. And once I think I've got it.
Photoshop, I'm sorry, I'm going to ask a total amateur question. Is that you on like a tablet drawing and then that gets sort of?
Yes. Well, you can use Photoshop on a tablet, but I use it on my desktop computer. But I am lucky enough to, so you can use elements of Photoshop on an iPad. So you can use the software on that. I use the software on my desktop computer, which is a Mac Mini, but I have a Wacom tablet and I sketch onto that. It's actually a screen that I can sketch onto.
Yeah.
That makes it really much quicker for me, though it does really do my neck and my shoulder in. But I take regular breaks.
Because I think that's what's so, like, hearing illustrators, they're always asking why, you know, tablet or iPad, and it obviously it's not my thing. So I'm like, oh, I don't know, don't you just all do it the same way? But no.
I think it's not really one best solution. If you're looking to economize, then definitely Procreate on the iPad, because although the iPad's expensive, Procreate is not, and it's very good technology. Yep. I'm a bit wedded to Adobe these days, but I do a bit of both.
Yep.
So I do it all in Photoshop, and then when I think I've got it, I send off my rough layout, and everyone goes through it very thoroughly, because for these books there's about 100 illustrations, so the character settings need to be consistent. Kids are very sharp-eyed.
Yes.
For instance, I rushed the last one at the end a bit, and I gave the wrong character a wooden leg.
Oh.
Fortunately, this was just the rough stuff.
Oh, funny.
So once Emily Rodder and the publisher and I, once we're all happy, the designer lays out the first pages, which is the first proper layout with a fully edited text as it would look when it's printed or as close to, but she still uses my roughs. Yeah. And I use her first pages to guide my finals. So there's lots of to and fro between us. And Kate Whitfield, the editor as well, has quite a large role in this, checking for consistency.
And so when does the actual cover get done and all of that?
The covers are often quite fraught. So for this one, we were well ahead with the cover for Monty One, which is Scary Mary and the Striped Spell. But then we realised we needed pictures of the next two covers on the back cover of that cover.
Yes.
And, of course, I hadn't read them yet. Oh. So it was suddenly like, what are we going to put on the front? So we're all desperately reading them and deciding.
Oh,
so,
wow.
But the next books, the covers are done, which is marvellous.
Yes.
For the first book, we did the covers for the next two very quickly.
And I'm just good. I'm looking at them, and they're all so glorious. So
they are.
They're amazing.
So I suppose we could tweak them a little bit for the final. But they're pretty much done. And we had to, obviously, I had to design the new characters for those quite carefully, because there's no point designing something to go on a cover and then finding you have to draw it 100 times for the next book and realizing it's not quite working. So
yes. Oh, dear. Oh, there's so much to know. And like, do you feel like you have just learned this on the run? Because like, you don't go to illustration school.
No, well, you can go to illustration school, but I didn't. I actually studied architecture. But don't feel like I've done it on the run because of my background in art direction and graphic design. Particularly art direction, you're sort of building stories around products, which and also using the technology I'm quite used to it and I still enjoy it, but I do like doing a lot of the hands-on stuff.
Yeah.
So doing the illustrations on the computer saves months, I reckon.
Yeah, okay.
And the problem is everyone is doing this, so now the expectations are that we'll be able to do things a lot quicker.
In
the older days, I'd be cutting out paragraphs of text and pasting them onto bits of paper and then sending sketches through by post or photograph and hoping the designer could work out where everything goes. So it saves.
And like, it's not even really the olden days. This is 2015 we're talking about.
Yes, well, we have broadband now, don't we? So
It does,
I don't think it hinders the creative process, other than the short timelines mean that often designers, illustrators and art directors don't have the time to let the ideas percolate so much.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is why I'm grateful these books have longer timelines, because I have time to reflect on the artwork and change it during. Nice. I've got a few months for this second book, for example.
So authors have editing of their work. Is there a similar process for illustrators? And if so, how do you navigate that process without falling into a pit of despair?
Well, this is where storyboards and roughs come in. So for junior fiction like this, hopefully we've ironed out all those changes in the roughs. And if there are changes in the finals, it's not such a big deal.
Yeah.
And I am used to last minute changes, and I'm generally open to suggestions because everybody wants the final work to be as good as it can be.
Yeah.
For picture books, it is more painful. So, yes. It can be hard if someone makes a change last minute. But again, and I've built the file carefully and put different characters on different layers in the file, then I can sometimes move them or change one thing without
affecting
the drawing.
Oh, so, yeah. Amazing, really, isn't it?
It is amazing.
Well, I mean, you know, when writers have their work edited, it's often months of, you know, structural despair, but... That sounds like slightly less painful, but yeah, I'm not an illustrator, so I cannot.
I think there is actual physical pain, as in illustration physical graft after a while. But then so is writing. I think my worst RSI has actually been from writing, not drawing. So.
Yes. I know, lots of people complain of that real, you know, that rigid shoulder pain because you're in that same position, because you have to be sort of,
Yeah.
So now that you've said you've got RSI from writing, do you write as well?
Yes, I love to write. And it's actually stories that make me want to draw. So originally I drew as a way of communicating the stories I had in my head.
Yeah.
I still love illustrating other people's work. It's really fun to take someone else's idea and help create a visual world for it. Yeah. But I also want to make my own worlds, if that makes sense. So I've written 5 picture books so far, though one of them, that being Duck Duck Moose, that only has 3 words. So
right.
For the storyboarding that went on in my head. And I think I've had a lot of questions about illustration, and I think that some people don't understand that illustrators have such a strong role in making the story as well, particularly for picture books.
Yeah.
It's not just all about, you know, decorating the book or having a particular style. It's about bringing the story to life.
Yep.
So for the writing, I have just finished a junior fiction novel, which hopefully will be out in September. And yes, I found the editing for that a bit painful, I have to.
Yep. Oh, well, keep us posted, because obviously we do share junior fiction as well on the Mavens.
Oh, great.
So
great to know. Yeah.
So tell us about simultaneous story time. What is it? How do we join? And how did you come to be a part of it? Now, I guess the caveat should be that with a pandemic happening, simultaneous story time may not go ahead as planned, but let's talk about it anyway.
Well, it's Alia are hoping it will go ahead in some digital form.
Yeah.
So National Simultaneous Storytime is when lots of schools, libraries and individuals read the book at the same time, the same book at the same time, a picture book. And this year it's 11 a.m. on the 27th of May. So it's organised by ALIA, the Australian Library and Information Association, if I've got it right, to promote the value of reading and literacy and always using an Australian children's book. So last year there were well over 1 million people reading Matt Cosgrove's Alpacas with Maracas.
Yes.
And I don't know if you saw the video with those alpacas, but it was
I saw it.
I couldn't stop kissing Matt. It's just lovely.
Too funny.
This year, the book will be Whitney and Brittany Chicken Divas, which has been written and illustrated by me.
Yes.
So I was utterly gobsmacked when Scholastic told me ALIA had chosen my book.
Yep.
And so Scholastic put the book forward to ALIA. And, it's wonderful. I'm just so happy for their support. And, yeah, really, I'm still really excited about it. I just hope I can get hold of some chickens.
Yes.
Anyway, I should better say that registering is simple and you can still register and it's still worth doing. So you just go to alia.org.au/NSS. So that's National Simultaneous Storytime.
Yep.
And then you can sign yourself up as an individual. And I think that once you're signed up, you can then add how many you'll be reading to and so on. So if it's doing it from school or a class or a kinder or a homeschooling group,
that's
what you can do.
Well, I mean, there's no reason why we can't still do this in the digital age. So,
we are making chicken puppets this week. So I need
saw that. To someone. So obviously you can sew as well.
Well, you don't need to be very good to sew fur. The glue does fine.
I guess. Yep. So this is a middle grade podcast and I know you have middle grade kids. So what is one middle grade book every child should have the opportunity of reading?
Well, there are quite a few.
Yes.
When I was a child, I really loved fantasy. And I think one writer who's been overlooked a lot is Diana Wynne Jones. I don't know if you've heard of that. So I loved her Crestomanci series growing up. And I really encourage children to read Charmed Life, which is her best one, I think, in this series. It's magical and it's a part of a multi-world book. So now we have Philip Pullman with his Dark Materials.
Yep.
So I would normally recommend that, but I think most people have read it. So I would say Crestomanci. Diane's amazing. Characters are still very alive and the ideas are incredible. And I think it's been copied quite a bit since.
Yes, I think it has been. So are there any other projects you are currently working on apart from the junior fiction that you mentioned, maybe in the middle grade space that you are at liberty to discuss?
Well, in that case, it would be the one that I've written. So this is junior, early, middle grade.
Yep.
So I don't know. What is middle grade, really?
It's meant to be 8 to 12, but if you're in the U.S., they consider middle grade to be 10 to 14 in the schooling system. But
that's fair, middle school.
Yeah, but Australia very much considers middle grade to be 8 to 12. So,
right. Well, my book, The Wolves of Greycoat Hall, which is out in September, is an early middle grade novel that I've written and it has loads of illustration. I'm telling you, loads. The author and the illustrator for this book were not always in sync.
Yes.
But I think I'm really pleased with it. I think it's going to be lovely. And of course, there's the next Monty book, which has it's an absolute corker. It's got terrifying, multiplying root vegetables with teeth.
Oh,
it's actually quite scary.
Well, we can't wait for either. Keep the mavens in the know. So, Lucinda, where can we find you online if our listeners are interested in checking out your work?
There's my website, which is lucindagifford.com. or lucindagiffordbooks.com. They're both the same, really. And I'm on Facebook as Lucinda Gifford Books and on Instagram just as Lucinda Gifford.
Brilliant. Well, it's been an utter delight to learn about your process, Lucinda. Thanks for joining the Mavens, and we look forward to seeing what comes our way in September.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you for inviting me on, Julie.
We hope you're hanging in there during this difficult time of COVID-19, and the Mavens are doing all they can to keep delivering new content to you fortnightly. Stay tuned for our bonus episode, folks, where we talk with a bookseller and a children's book publisher about the changing face of the children's book publishing industry. If you'd like to know more about the Mavens, log on to middlegradepodcast.com, or to find Julie online, drop by julieanngrassobooks.com. And to find Pamela, stop by www.uckerman.net.